And then you can repeat the word, call and response. So can you hear me in the back? Okay. So I will try to speak. Namo. Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Buddham Saranam Gacchami Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Sangham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Anicca vata sankara upaduvayo damino upakituva nerutanti tesang upasamo suko. All things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Those who can be at peace with this will be happy. May whatever benefits that come from our use of this building, sitting and practicing here, may it be for the benefit of all beings everywhere, for all beings that we meet and encounter, and for all the beings that will be using this building after us. May the field of goodness, which has brought us this building and created this space, be a field of goodness that spreads on down through the years and the generations. May all beings be happy. May all beings everywhere be free. So welcome everyone. And next Sunday, we're going to have our opening celebration. And as part of that, there'll be various things that are going to happen, kind of ceremonial, ritual, a little bit. And as we do that, one of the things that's going to happen is we're going to read the first discourse of the Buddha, which is the sutta on turning the wheel of the Dharma. And it felt appropriate to kind of the official kind of opening celebration to let the words of the Buddha be the Dharma talk. And in a sense, the first words that he gave, the first teachings he gave, have been the core of Buddhist teaching ever since. All of Buddhism can be understood as an elaboration of those first teachings. And specifically, those teachings have to do with the Four Noble Truths. And I know some people think that Four Noble Truths are quaint or kind of irrelevant or kind of simplistic, or think that they're easy to understand, but let's get on to something more profound. And in my over 25 years of Buddhist practice, I've come to appreciate not only the profundity of the Four Noble Truths, but also the brilliance of the Buddha formulating the path, the religious life or the spiritual life that he offered, formulated from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths, because it focuses very directly, it points very directly at the core issue to be resolved for liberation, without anything extra, without any extra metaphysics or belief systems or speculations, or it's really a radically simple, metaphysically free system or framework for understanding our life. And it's very helpful, I think, not to have metaphysics tied into the spiritual path, because sometimes it's very inspiring, but sometimes it lends itself to what the Buddha called a thicket of views, a quagmire of views. There's a lot of when metaphysical beliefs come into play, they often sometimes kind of don't quite match, don't quite fit. They don't quite. If you start really looking into them carefully, they start falling apart for us. I've heard Christian theologians tell Buddhists, you don't want to get involved in Buddhist academic studies because you'll lose your religion. Because many Christians who go into academic study of Christianity will find that some of the very tenets of Christianity begin to kind of unravel for them as they really look at them under a kind of critical eye. So in offering a spiritual path that has no metaphysical belief system, it offers something that's radically simple. And in a sense, some people could say that it maybe it's not a religion at all. Maybe it's not even a spiritual practice at all. In the time of the Buddha, he was known as the great physician, the great doctor, the great surgeon. And the similarity to medicine has for what the Buddhism Buddha had to offer has I think it's also very helpful. Maybe it's more medicine than it is religion or therapy, or you know, it's really good medicine. The Four Noble Truths is like the best pill you could take. And in fact, the Four Noble Truths were formulated based on the model, ancient Indian model, of how doctors diagnosed illnesses or looked at illness. So the framework in which doctors used. So if you go to your doctor and something ails you, maybe it's even really serious, and you go to your doctor and she says, well, nice to see you, and do you play chess? And you say, well, does that have to do anything? Well, I'm just, you know, like to know my patients a little bit, and what's your golf score? And, oh, you don't play golf. Oh, you know, what kind of, you know, what's your favorite cookbook? And, or television program, or do you see what was on, what do people watch? I don't watch, last week, Survivor. And, you know, you only have 15 minutes, and it's, you know, $200 appointment. And it goes on, and, you know, these questions, and you wonder, you know, and finally, you know, after 14 minutes, you say, you know, shouldn't you be interested in what ails me? And to be interested in what ails us is necessary if you have an illness. And if you don't have that interest in what ails you, someone doesn't have an interest, if the doctor doesn't have an interest, then you think something is wrong. So from the point of view of a spiritual life, the Buddha was a physician pointing to the very core problem, which he defined as suffering. And according to what the Buddha had to offer, there's other things to do, I suppose, in spiritual lives, but what the Buddha was most keenly interested in was how to live a life where there was no suffering. A suffering-free life is a pretty good thing. And the quest for that happiness and that peace that has no suffering is what the Buddha's path is all about. Or at least half of it. The other half is offering that to other people, supporting other people in doing that, responding in compassion to the world, suffering of the world. And so if the goal is to be free of that suffering and discover the amazing grace, the amazing peace or happiness that's possible, and that happens, then we have to understand the nature of that suffering. And the first, in a sense, responsibility that the Buddha offered people on the path is the responsibility to understand their suffering. People come to Buddhism, and some people react and say, well, gee, you know, I came to get away from my suffering, I came to be inspired, to get hope, to get you know, anything but my suffering. And then people get angry when you tell them, you have to pay attention to your suffering. And they think it's an affront, because it's a personal failing that they have suffering, or it's, you know, it's not just not what's supposed to happen. And I've also known people who've been very inspired to come in into hear a Buddhist Dharma talk, for example, because they really felt there was some fundamental suffering in life, in society that's going on. And in their experience, no one was talking about it. There were a lot of people denying it, prettying it up, and not really being calling it for what it is. And hopefully, often, at least sometimes, Buddhist Dharma talks are insisting that you have to really acknowledge and recognize what is actually so. Not as a way of being depressed by it, not as a way of being morbid about it, but as really recognizing and being honest, so that you can be your own doctor, so that you can find what it takes to be free from suffering. So the first responsibility, the Buddha said, is the study of your own suffering, to get to know it. And that goes from the most subtle, from simply very, very mild irritation or complaining about how something is, to phenomenally profound psychological personal traumas that can come sometimes from childhood trauma or tragedies. Or there's all the whole realm, range of suffering. And the responsibility is to stop and look at it all, wherever it arises. And I know in my own life that in my practice, sometimes I've looked at some of the important suffering in my life and practiced with it and all that. And I've overlooked a lot of the subtle things, the subtle ways of complaining and being irritated. And if the practice is really going to be integrated throughout our life, it has to be in all those planes, all those realms. And in fact, sometimes by looking at the subtlety, the small things that irritate us and we complain about and are annoyed about or resist, things that often we overlook, it often provides a wonderful door for dealing with the more important stuff. It lays the foundation for dealing with the more important suffering we have, which is sometimes too difficult for some of us to look at directly. But we need to create a foundation of peace and well-being or dealing with things to be able to look at it. So the Buddha, as a doctor, first talked about our responsibility as our own doctors to, in a sense, Buddhism is medical school, right? with it's much more pleasant. I hope. I had heard horror stories. This last retreat I taught just ended yesterday. There were, for some reason, a lot of medical students there. And maybe it's just this time of year they can get away. People don't get sick during holidays or something. I don't know why they were free, but there were a lot of medical students, and every single one of them came and talked about the horrors of the stress, long hours. And it's a paradox of being involved in the system. The medical system is there to help people suffer less, and then we kind of grind them, you know, for everything they're worth, seemingly, in this very training that they get to do that. But Buddhism is kind of a medical school for us, where we're being trained to be our own doctors, which requires that we, from time to time, find out, recognize what our suffering is. One of the sufferings we can have is secondary suffering, or tertiary suffering, which is we suffer because we suffer. Or we suffer because we suffer because we suffer. Or, you know, some of us, it's, you know. And so, if I stub my toe, which happens, and then I get angry with myself for being clumsy, that's a secondary suffering I've added on top of that. And that self-criticism is optional, but it causes the suffering. The pain is the pain, and the suffering is the way we react and respond to the pain or the joy of life. And then I feel angry with myself for being clumsy, and then I'm embarrassed because I don't want to let you all know that I'm angry with myself because I'm a Dharma teacher. I shouldn't be. So now I'm embarrassed, which is a tertiary form of suffering. And then I'm depressed because one more time I'm embarrassed. And then that's, you know, the fourth level, fourth generation. And then I get afraid because I'm depressed. And then, on it goes. And so we try not to do that, but of course we do. And the practice is to see all that and to find out where in that chain of reactivity we can wake up, where we can stop adding, the Buddhist language is, the arrows that cause more suffering. So in order to do that, the Buddha talked about the second noble truth. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering, sometimes in popular books or understanding, is defined by the Buddha to be desire. And but the Buddha didn't use the word desire. Because if you use the word desire, you're in trouble. Because desires are a dime a dozen. They come really easily to most people. We're kind of like, you know, homo desirous. You know, it's kind of like all we do. we want something, we don't want something else. And it's very easy. It comes kind of naturally. So it isn't, you know, if we just weren't to be critical or, you know, desire, we're in trouble. We wouldn't be human. But the Buddha didn't use the word desire, but he used the word thirst. That thirst is the cause of suffering. And thirst is kind of a physical kind of experience, to be thirsty. I take it to be a non-technical term at the time of the Buddha. It wasn't like any, you know, it wasn't like a, you know, technical religious term. It was just when you're thirsty. And I translate it into English sometimes as the word drivenness, which as far as I know is not a technical term. To be driven, except in Silicon Valley. To be driven, or to act under compulsion. When we're no longer, when we're driven, when we're kind of slaves, or an automatic pilot, and our drivenness drives the desire. So it's not simply a desire or an aversion, but the desire, the aversion has a compelling compulsion that's built into it, where we're not really free. But the desire itself is what's flowing through us, demanding that things have to be a certain way. And sometimes that compulsion can be phenomenally powerful. Sometimes people can't sit still. Sometimes they explode, almost, because the power of their desire and their demands are such. I mean, you can name it, you know, sometimes. Lust can be that way. Have you ever not been able to sit still because of lust? I have. I couldn't sleep one night because of it. You know, restless, tossing and turning. Or feelings of aversion or anger. Kind of, they're there in a compulsive way, and they're kind of taking over. So I think of drivenness as the cause of the reactive behavior that causes suffering, causes us to contract, to tighten up. And so part of the responsibility is to understand the causes of it, to understand this form of drivenness or compulsion as it drives our life. And in saying this, I think it's useful to distinguish between popular American understandings of freedom and Buddhist understandings of freedom. This is a little bit simplistic, but I think it's useful, at least pedagogically, to kind of make this distinction. And I think that the kind of popular American understanding of freedom is mostly freedom to. Freedom, the right or freedom to bear arms, to shop. to get out of my way, the right of the individual to do whatever they want in their own home, in their own property, in the pursuit of their own happiness. And it's certainly a very important freedom in many ways, but it can mask compulsion, where we feel this tremendous compulsion to have what we want. I want it, I want it, I want it. And get out of my way. I deserve it. There shouldn't be any limitations on me. And in extreme forms, it's actually kind of an infantile relationship to the world. And you're not really free if you're simply taking away the limitations for your compulsions to get free rein. At least from a Buddhist point of view, that's the case. And so from a Buddhist point of view, freedom is defined as the absence of compulsion. It's freedom from something. So instead of freedom to do whatever you want, it's a freedom from something. And it's freedom from compulsion, from drivenness. So that we become, in a sense, masters of our own lives. So in a sense, we become in charge of our life, so that we're free in our lives to act in wise and helpful ways. So the second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering, which is what we need to understand and ultimately let go of, to release that. If you understand this really well, then the hope is that your encounter with Buddhist practice is not going to cause you to suffer more, which it is, unfortunately, for too many of us. Not always, but sooner or later, if you practice, you're going to be sitting there meditating, for example, as an example, and you're going to say, gee, I'm not very concentrated. That happens. It's pretty common for human beings to find themselves not very concentrated. It happens to me all the time. That's okay. Then, I'm a failure as a meditator. A meditator is someone who's supposed to be, you know, this pristine, beautiful, concentration and is able to, every time they sit down, is able to be able to ride each breath right off into the sunset. Boy, am I ever! I can never succeed at anything that I do. Okay, is that better now? Is that better for everyone? Much better, huh? Okay, so that was the mystery. Sorry for those of you. So what you have to realize here is that it's going to take us a while to know how to use this place and get everything right and kind of, you know. And we're all going to have to be patient for a while as we kind of sort through, you know, all the little ways in which we want to adjust and make this place work for us. And we'll be experimenting over the next weeks with different ways of sitting and different ways of all kinds of things. And eventually we'll experiment with different color glass windows. But in the meantime, I certainly hope that you don't suffer because of this. Because, now this is one of the difficult things to say, and one of the challenges, one of the biggest challenges of Buddhism, I believe, and it can be misunderstood when this is said. So some of you misunderstand it. The idea is, what I'm about to say, you take it as a kind of a koan. You take it as a contemplative statement that you don't take as another reason to suffer about yourself or feel bad about yourself. But you take it as a something to carry with you, as a possibility to help you explore and understand your life better. And the challenge of Buddhist teachings is that you're responsible for your suffering. You're responsible for your suffering. So one of the functions in a mindfulness practice is, in the field of mindfulness practice, and that practice itself, is to always turn the attention away from the so-called object that bothers us to what our own subjective experience is about that. So if you don't like the sound of the traffic when we're sitting here, the training in mindfulness is to certainly recognize it with its traffic sounds, whatever, and then to turn the attention back to yourself to understand, if you're suffering about it, what's going on in you? Because it's really not necessary to suffer around traffic sounds. It's not inherent in the nature of life that traffic sounds produce aversion or clinging or judgment or resistance or comparison to what a real meditation center should be like or what quiet one. A real meditation center in Asia would have the neighborhood loudspeakers blaring away, playing Madonna's famous song, Just Like a Virgin, what's it called? In Burmese, luckily. Over and over and over again. And when not doing that, then the neighboring monastery next door to your monastery will start chanting Buddhist lists out loud over the loudspeaker 24 hours a day for 7 days. That's what a real monastery is like. Here in the West, we think it's supposed to be silent. So the responsibility is to turn around and look. And that's where the really dynamic and interesting and powerful work will really be. What is going on with me? Where's the clinging? Where's the compulsion? Where's the thirst? Where's the judgment? What am I clinging to? And the Buddha enumerated a lot of things that we could cling to. He had various kinds of lists. They chant over the loudspeakers. He talked about clinging to ethics and religious practice. And I'm sure that's a great relief to you. You know, you don't have to cling to those. It was easy. But for some people. But that's a form of, that causes tremendous suffering for ourselves, to cling to our, ethics is very, very powerful and important for Buddhism, be ethical. And religious practice is an essential part of Buddhism too. But to cling to it is a form of a lot of suffering. And sooner or later, most of us will do our practice and suffer because of it. We'll judge ourselves, we'll want things to be different, we resist how things actually are. And it's a little bit of a paradox that we have this wonderful system that's alleviating suffering, that we use it to measure ourselves and compare ourselves to suffer more. That's kind of human nature. And luckily, the practice is self-correcting. So that gets corrected with time. And I thought I'd made phenomenal progress in my years of practice. It wasn't what I expected progress to look like. But I thought I'd made a lot of progress when I can get through a retreat without getting angry. Usually with myself. So there's clinging to ethics and religious practices. There's also clinging to, the Buddhist word is views. But views, to use that word implies kind of opinions, and everyone knows they're not opinionated. It's the other people. And but I think it's much more, if you really understand views and their power in our lives, it's much more subtle than just simply our kind of views and opinions. It can include the assigning of meaning that we put on our experience. And the meaning we put in our experience is more often than not different than the actual experience itself. And we tend to cling to that meaning. What is that meaning? What is the meaning that we're clinging to? What's that view that we're clinging to? Meaning of what it means to be a good person, meaning what it means to be an acceptable person, meaning what it, all kinds of things. Meaning of a particular experience. Meaning this and that. The room is quite full today. So I could easily suffer by looking at that and say, oh, this means that you guys aren't happy because you feel crowded. That could be true. But I don't know that until you tell me. But I assign that meaning. The actual experience is that the room is full. What's the meaning that I assign to that? So we cling to meaning. We cling to a sense of self, which is very closely related to a sense of meaning, because we have ideas of what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a self, and relationship to other beings, other people. Clinging to a sense of self, I am something, and I have to defend it, hold on to it, build it up, is a tremendous form of suffering. And for some people, you can kind of imagine the degree of joy and happiness and peace that can come when a person can walk through life without any need to defend themselves, prove themselves, hide themselves, be anything for anybody. And then the fourth clinging is a clinging to comfort and sensual pleasure. It isn't that it's bad to have those things, but the clinging to it, the wanting it, and then the conversely, the aversion and resistance to discomfort is one of the fundamental sufferings, the causes of suffering for human beings. And in fact, it might sound kind of simplistic to say that, you know, we cling to sensual pleasure, you know, and you know, it doesn't apply to me or applies to me only when I'm close to the refrigerator or something. But the... More often than probably we realize, the way in which we're responding to experiences in life is not to the meaning there or to the experience there in some more complex way, but it's very simple, is this pleasant or unpleasant? And so we hold on or we push away. Basically, on a very simple premise, is it pleasant or unpleasant? And some people are very attached, cling to that very powerfully. People come to retreats, for example, and say, Do I have to sit with my physical pain? You don't have to sit with pain necessarily. Sometimes it's wise not to. But if every chance you get, you avoid your discomfort, you'll never discover the freedom from compulsion. And to really learn how to be free, you have to learn how to sit still with equanimity or peace or non-reactivity, with whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering, the end of suffering. It's possible to end this clinging. And it can be done in small ways. And in fact, it's very interesting to study how often this happens in our daily life. The cessation of clinging and suffering happens probably 10,000 times in the course of our daily life. But we often don't notice it. You might have a desire for the green light or for the red light to turn green before you reach the intersection. And maybe you're in a little bit of a hurry, so you're a little bit anxious and you're really kind of, you know, praying that happens. And you don't even notice, for example, you've tensed up a tiny bit around the traffic light. And then whatever happens in traffic light happens, and then you're off the next block, and you're no longer clinging to that traffic light being a certain way. That desire has now been liberated. It's been finished. It's gone away. And I don't know if that's the best example, but there's a lot of small ways in which our, and big ways, which our desires are clinging. It's actually released through the day because, and to study that, to recognize that, to stop, kind of recognize that that's happening, and to feel maybe the satisfaction or the peace, in a small way, of that no longer being here. To appreciate that lends itself then to well, certainly to understanding the relevance of the Four Noble Truths. And then there's the big release of clinging. The biggest one is the experience of Nibbana, of the deathless. They're radically and totally complete letting go of consciousness itself. So that any remnants, any small, any form of clinging in the heart mind are completely eliminated. And one of the great reasons I'm inspired by the Buddha and why I wanted to start with chanting this homage to the Buddha today is that the Buddha represents someone who has discovered this, who's fulfilled or realized this potential that's in the hearts and minds of all of us to be absolutely and completely liberated from the causes of suffering within our own hearts and minds. To enter into the world and to walk through the world without any tendency for ourselves to add to the suffering, to ourselves or to the world around us. There's no clinging, there's no resistance, there's no hate, there's no greed. Cessation of suffering. The Buddha then said, or in the Four Noble Truths, the fourth truth is the Eightfold Path. And so the first three is a suffering, there's a cause of suffering, and there's a cessation of suffering. It sounds very easy. The fourth Noble Truth is recognition that it's not easy to do it thoroughly and completely. And so we need to put together the conditions that support that happening. The Buddhist 8-step program. And so it's right understanding. And the right understanding is understood to be, right to you, is to really understand how the Four Noble Truths are a useful framework for understanding our life experience. The Four Noble Truths are not meant to be truths in kind of philosophical way or metaphysical way, but they're really true or useful. It's like a tool is true. It's a true tool, I mean, I think you said maybe a true tool or something. It's something that's really useful. It's not any less or more true than the metric system. Is the metric system, it might be more useful than the English system of measurement, but is it truer? You know, than using inches and feet? It's just a way of dividing up our experience, a category, a framework to make it a lot easier for us to get through things. So in the same way, the Four Noble Truths are very useful frameworks for understanding our lives. And what the Buddha said is that they're more useful and wiser to use those as frameworks, to use any framework of understanding your life that's based on the idea of a self. The Buddha never denied that there's a self. But he said if you use a framework of the self to find your happiness, you're never going to ultimately find it. It's not going to be useful for you. So if you're looking for the true self or the infinite self or trying to take a self and merge the self with the cosmos, so if you're trying to discover an independent self, or there's all these kind of ways in which we use the word self as being the agenda for what our life is all about. And it's very radically a radical teaching for the Buddha to say, any framework that you use that has to do with the sense of self, using the idea of a self as a framework for looking for your happiness, leads you to it keeps you in the world of suffering. And so the alternative framework the Buddha offered was the Four Noble Truths. So to use that framework is the first of the Eightfold Path. Understand that framework. The second is right intention. To have the right aspiration, a good aspiration. To have the aspiration and intention for our life to come and arise out of the goodness of our hearts. Then there's right speech, or good speech. Speech that comes out of the goodness of our hearts. Then there's good livelihood that comes out of the goodness of our hearts. How would we live our lives? How would we make a living if it really is an expression of the goodness of our hearts rather than other things that it can be an expression of? Then there's good action, our behavior in general. If it comes from the goodness of our hearts, it helps lay the foundation and the conditions for doing this very, very radically transformative thing of letting go, of bringing an end to our suffering and clinging. And then there's right effort, or good effort, effort and engagement, which comes from the goodness of our being, of our heart. And then there's good mindfulness that comes also, hopefully, from a wholehearted effort, a wholeheartedness, a goodness of who we are. And then there's good concentration, same thing. Ability to be focused and composed in the middle of our experience. In a good way, in a good-hearted way. So the Four Noble Truths, I understand to be, when the Buddha taught them, to be an expression of his love. That he had tremendous compassion and love for the world and for us. And he chose not to avoid helping, but he chose to actually, for 45 years, based on that compassion and love, to engage in the world and offer the medicine that hopefully would help all of us with our own suffering. And this is what's continued now for 2,500 years. And in doing that, in taking that pill, that medicine, it tends to bring forth the goodness and the love in those who take the medicine. And I'm very conscious that as we sit here in this building, that we now have this Insight Meditation Center, that we're sitting in a field of goodwill. The lot of people, infinite people, people we don't even know directly, and people we do know, people in this room, have contributed their goodwill in many different forms and made possible for us to buy this and to fix it up to the degree which we have now and to be here together as a group. And when I look out and see this building and come and when I think of coming here, I don't see physical walls and floors as much as I see the whole place embodies goodwill, generosity, trust, practice, dedication, and sincerity of many, many people.
That's an exclamation point.
Yeah. It's exactly time to stop, so. Maybe that's. So I'm very grateful for all of you and for being here and coming for our first day. If anything was awkward about being here for this first day, please be patient as we kind of sort out all the details and make it work as smoothly and as possible. And next week we'll have the opening celebration, and it should be quite nice what we have planned. And we'll definitely rearrange the seating arrangement for that. So we can use both L's, and probably the people speaking will be up there so we can see them from both sides, both rooms. And then afterwards we'll have an informal potluck, so please, you know, come and hang out. And the couple of announcements I have. This coming Thursday, we have our first Thursday evening sitting here. And the Thursday evening sittings have now been moved to 7:30. They used to be at 7 in Palo Alto. Now been moved to 7:30. And this Thursday is the first Thursday of the 5-week introductory course. And then after this particular introductory course, the plan is to move the introductory course to Wednesday. So the Thursday will always be just regular sitting group, the way it is, rather than not, you know, being bumped off every 3 times a year for the intro class. And then our first kind of one-day event, sitting event, is Richard Shankman comes this Saturday to teach a one-day kind of a retreat, teaching retreat, a lot of sitting and practice, but also a little bit more teaching than the usual one-day sittings that I lead. And then next Sunday is the opening, and then there was one mistake in the newsletter. We're going to start having half-day sittings. In the beginning, on the one Wednesday, just on Wednesday mornings, like once in January and once in March, and if they look like they're really working well, we'll maybe even do them every week. And the first one will be the 30th of January, but the newsletter says the 30th of February, which never comes. You'll be waiting a long time. And so also, if you can be a little bit patient, because we'd like to make a few more announcements. I think, Diane, you want to talk a little bit about the parking?
When you come, what? The street where you have to go is Birch, and to keep the spots closest to the meditation
hall. And perhaps over the those people who come regularly will kind of learn where the parking lots are and use those so that people who don't come regularly don't know where they are. You know, will find street parking. And also, you know, it's... And if you're, you know, fit and all kinds of wonderful things, parking further away to help alleviate some of the pressure on the neighbors would be a nice thing. We don't want it to be a burden for you, but if it works nice, to do that, to incorporate that as part of your coming here, it would be a good thing. There is the Caltrans train, which is relatively close.
You want to go further out along the side of the high school.
And we also have a parking lot we can use down this street, down Birch. So over time, some of you will learn where these things are, and we'll help out. The other thing is, it's an opening celebration next week. When the Buddha decided to go teach, he said, he was the god Brahma came and said, please come and beat the drum of the deathless. And the Buddha said, the doors of the deathless are open. So beating the drum of the deathless is a very strong and kind of important statement in the Buddhist texts. And we're going to have a drum, hopefully have a drum here, to have a very amazing beating of the drum. But that requires getting the drum. And it's the big Buddha drum that they have at the San Francisco Zen Center in the hallway down next to the Zendo. Some of you have been there. And what do we? They'll let us bring it down here if we pick it up kind of Saturday afternoon, the 12th, and bring it back Sunday after our event. But it requires a truck, and they said it requires 3 strong people to carry it into the truck. And a lot, they said you better bring it a lot of blankets because you know they don't want their precious drum damaged in any way.
What if it's raining? Is that a problem?
Well, if it's raining, we can cover it as long as we have a truck. It can't be a pickup then. So if anybody has something like that, if it's sunny, a pickup, or if it's not sunny, a truck, or anything, any people can volunteer. Maybe you should ask anybody who can help with that, either transporting it or helping. So if it's, I think it probably won't fit because it's not only a big drum, but it's also the stand that it's on. And then we need a couple of people to go with you if you can do it. You can help. And anybody else who might be available? Right. So why don't you talk to Bill? And we don't know if...
Talk about this again tomorrow.
And then if we need, we'll make an announcement again tomorrow. Taking it back and forth, yeah, one time. Saturday and then Sunday. I mean, well, it is, I think it needs to be pretty similar because it's a big drum and the rivets on the drum are as important as the drum part. So it has to have rivets in the same way. You have to come and see. It's like taiko drumming. So, yes.
Just to worry about next week and flowers. Would you like us to bring flowers and should they be in a vase?
It would be nice to bring some flowers, but in a vase. But I'm afraid of having too many. So, why don't you? Can you be the flower coordinator? And anybody here wants to bring flowers next week? Why don't you talk to Diane? And let's not get more than, you know, maybe 10. Kind of something, so that we don't know what, you know. But it would be very nice to have flowers and you know, actually, we have almost no planning for this event. So when the person from Zen Center was to come down to do the drumming for us, asked, well, when's the rehearsal going to be? Because the Zen Center, they rehearse every ceremony they do because it's so complex. I said, don't worry about that. Just know your piece. It's kind of, I said, I don't know if this is, you know, a nice thing to say or what. But anyway, I said to her, it's kind of like we're kind of like the Quakers doing a ceremony. You know, it's kind of informal, but it'll happen kind of in its own way. But we have a few things like people to help set up and clean up from the potluck and, you know, all those kinds of things. So. Yeah, more or less the same schedule. But once we come back to sit at 9:25, you want to be here on time because we're not going to. That's not going to be a really long sitting. It'll be actually very short, maybe just a few minutes, and then we'll start in with the various events that we'll do, and then it might go longer than 10:45. It might go to 11:30, the ceremony and talking celebration. So, yes. Children are most welcome at the 9:25. We'll see what happens. Yes?
Gil, I've got a camera, and I feel moved to document some of this, but I don't want to be intrusive. Would it be okay if I took a picture or two this morning and had one about next week?
It's fine. So if there's anyone who would like to help next week with any kind of the arrangements and making it happen smoothly and in a warm, welcoming way, it would be good if they could talk to someone to volunteer. Who would like to be the coordinator for that? Dave, you don't so much coordinate. I think we should, let's focus on. Great. So many thanks and.